Hello and welcome to the Sci-Fi FX Podcast, episode number 134. I'll be your host today, Carl, and with me I have Matt.
Hello, everyone.
And today we are continuing our Doctor Who Series 7 review series. It's a lot of series. We're moving on with the fourth episode in Series 7A, The Power of Three, written by Chris Chibnall and directed by Douglas McKinnon. So, what did you think about this one, Matt?
I don't know. I've had mixed feelings about this one. You know, originally I didn't like it at all, and I went back recently and rewatched a few of these just so that I could kind of have an idea of what was going on. And I don't know. I don't think this was one of their greatest efforts. It's kind of very much a filler. And this one compared to an episode, remind me in what is it? Two episodes from now? There's a real disparity between this one and I don't even remember which one it is now.
I'm kind of with you on this one. I kind of have a love-hate relationship with this episode. Because, yeah, it does feel a lot like time filler. And, I mean, it opens up there and there's, like, lens flare all over the screen. And for a second, I thought that... So at first there, I kind of thought that, you know, did J.J. Abrams start directing this episode of Doctor Who? Because there was just like lens flare all over the place at the beginning of this episode. And it drove me nuts because, you know, there's no reason for that.
Yeah, and I don't know. The story itself seemed a little weak to me, too. I mean, it was... And this goes back to a thing that I used to believe in, and I'm not so sure I do anymore, but... And this is the problem that I have with lack of continuity of any kind. You end up with these just weak stories. I mean, this is just a weak story. I mean, a bunch of boxes show up and the doctor, you know, and which one, which episode is it where the doctor's a monk?
That is Bells of St. John.
Okay. So, in that one, he's a monk and he sits around and he does nothing for, you know, for years waiting for Claire to show up. And in this one, he can't sit still for 10 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, and so it just kind of, I don't know. There's a lot of this one that I'm just not sure I liked any of it. I mean, I don't know. It just didn't. This one didn't grab me. And it's kind of strange, too, because I'm usually, you know, pretty lenient on especially Doctor Who. But this one was just, it seemed weak. It seemed like it was just lazy. We got to throw something together for this week. Oh, let's just have a bunch of magic boxes show up. I mean, the power of three, really? What does the power of three have to do with anything, you know?
Well, exactly. There were some things I really liked about it. One was Kate Stewart, the Brigadier's daughter, is now in charge of UNIT. Which,
yes,
they went way back for that because Kate was originally mentioned in some of the non-canonical fan-made stories back in the 90s when Doctor Who was off the air. That was when Kate Stewart, the Brigadier's daughter, was first created as a character. So it's kind of nice to have that formalized at this point, and she's now in charge of UNIT. And they do make a callback to the classic series by mentioning that she tracked the Doctor down by his Arctron energy, which was mentioned a few times in the classic series, and I think a couple times in the new series at this point. But yeah, one of the things that really bugged me in this episode was that the Doctor just goes stir crazy for... You know, after having been there a couple of hours, basically, with nothing going on. Yeah. But yeah, like you said, yet he can become a monk for several years and occupy himself making paintings and stuff like that, or After this, after the next episode, the Angels Take Manhattan, once Amy and Rory leave him, he goes off and he's, by himself essentially for, who knows how many years at that point.
Yeah, that was, and that was the,
Just kind of sulking about in Victorian England.
yeah, and not even in his, not even traveling or anything. He's just kind of sulking and, pouting and all that. So that kind of annoyed me. I mean, there was just, there just seemed to be a lot of laziness. I mean, even the part that it, the things that I did like is the introduction of his dad. I mean, that not the introduction of his dad, but his dad being there. I thought that was
Oh
kind
yeah,
of, that was kind
Brian.
of, yeah.
Again, Brian's awesome, man. He's a great character.
I mean, he has this ability to do nothing and do it very well.
Yeah. And I mean, the cubes themselves, they did some really nice effects work on the cubes, like putting Amy's pulse on it and when the countdown's going on it. That looked really good. But yeah, I mean, it's just these cubes all over the place. And I'm all for the slower story. I like for the story to build and build up to a certain point, and then all hell breaks loose. And
Yeah,
that's
and I
why the
have no
doctor's
problem
there.
with that.
The problem is this one builds really slow, basically, for the first 30, 35 minutes of the story. And then all hell breaks loose, and we've literally got 10 minutes left to fix the problem. So that's when the doctor whips out his magic wand, I mean, sonic screwdriver, points it at a computer screen, and does a mass defib on everybody to fix them. And
Yeah.
I'm sitting there watching this going, wait a minute. Hasn't it been 20, 30 minutes since the cubes gave everybody a heart attack? Shouldn't those people be
Yeah,
dead?
that was
I
my thought too, is
mean,
that
if it's.
all these people had died and here we are, they're all back, and we have a, that seems to be a trend in the next couple of episodes, is that Sonic Screwdriver is the magic wand.
Well, it has been since it came back, yeah.
Well, it's even more so now though, because I mean before it was a little bit, I mean like in a town called Mercy he was using it to get readouts on things like that. And it was used that way, but it wasn't as blatant as, point at it and psh, okay, we refibbed everybody and they're all
Yeah.
back alive again.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, those people, a lot of those people had been, had a heart attack and had been laying in the street. It's not like they were at a hospital and people were trying to do resuscitation or, defib them with a defibrillator during this time. You had, millions of people around the planet just fall over from a heart attack. If it's been more than a minute or two or a handful of minutes, you're not bringing them back. And what about all the people that were, oh, I don't know, in airplanes where the pilot had a
Yeah.
heart attack? Or were driving down the street and they had a heart attack and rammed into somebody or drove off a bridge. We don't see any of that.
No, we didn't. And it was all kind of just wishy-washy pushed by. Like I said, it was a very sloppy episode. It was like someone threw it together in a few minutes and then just chose to sweep everything under the rug as they went along. Oh, well, planes falling out of the sky, let's just not talk about it because if we do, it'll ruin everything. And the fact that they're laying around in the streets for, who knows how long. I mean, I find it hard to believe that all that happened in 30 minutes, but okay, let's say 30 minutes and, let's just sweep that under the rug. They're brain dead after 5 minutes.
Yeah,
They're not
exactly.
coming back, but in this case, 30 minutes, no problem.
Then you have the Chakri and this tally. What is it a tally for? They still haven't gone back and touched on any of that stuff. What was this tally for? What was the whole point of that? Tell us some more about the Chakri. They show up in this one episode for, like 5 minutes. And it's just a hologram of one at that. And they pull they pull Brian off of the Chakri ship there at the end as it's exploding and everything. But they left all those other people that were laying there on the gurneys. Were those people dead? Were they just in comas? Were they, sedated? Did Did they leave those people there to die, or were they already dead? What about the other seven, or the other six Chakri ships? Because they said there were seven of them. I'm assuming there were people taken hostage on those ships as well. That this one wasn't the only one where they took Brian, and that's the only place they had these people.
Well, and they were also very weak about the entrances and about the way they got into the thing and stuff like that. So you're telling me that all this time they've been there and no one just happened to go down that hall and get in that elevator? I mean, just no one?
On yeah, and I mean it. The whole point of this slow invasion, where they drop all these cubes on the planet, was the cubes studied everybody. They found out our weaknesses, and then they used that against us, right? That was the whole point
Right.
of the story. So why were the Chakri taking people onto the ship? They never mentioned anything about why they had all those people up there. What was the point?
There was more questions left with this one than there was answers. And then when it didn't, when the questions arose to cause problems, they were just ignored completely and totally. Like I just and. I don't mind. I love the, I mean, I'm a fan of old slow war movies where they sit in a hole the whole time waiting for the other guy to attack. That's me. I don't mind that kind of a story. I like that kind of a story, actually. Not that I have anything against the, Avengers style action packed from beginning to end type movie, but
They
I
each
don't
have their
mind the slow
place.
story. Yeah, they each have their place. And you can tell both stories, and I can be entertained with both of them just as well, but this one just. I don't know. I mean, even the brief history of 7 seasons, none of it seemed to match. It just, none of it made any sense. I mean, usually there's some kind of something in history they pull from to where you kind of got some backstory that you don't even know about,
Yeah, this is
or.
all brand new, other than the fact that they had UNIT in it, and they brought
Now
Kate
that part was
Stewart.
cool.
And yeah, that was the only, well, there was one other cool part, the chicken dance cube.
The chicken, yeah.
They have it in that soundproof container. He opens the door and it's blasting the chicken dance. I did like that. That was funny.
I'm not even sure what they could have changed to make it better. And maybe this is one of those where, they have to invent new bad guys every now and then, and some of them fly and some of them don't.
And I don't
And
have
this
a
just
problem
happened
with
to.
them inventing new bad guys. But there should be a point to them. It shouldn't just be this hologram that shows up talking about how they have to collect the tally, and not explain any of that.
Yeah.
That's.
Well, and that this is the problem that I have with complete and total, story autonomy and lack of any cohesiveness to the stories, because then you end up with a bunch of crap like this. I mean, you at least when you're telling a big story, if you get on a big story, it's either a good story and you can watch the whole thing and most episodes are good, or it's a bad story and you can kind of skip it and wait for the next one. In cases like this, half the episode you don't know what's going to be good or really bad, and it just kind of this one's just crap. It
Now,
really
see,
is. I
I prefer them having the standalone stories because even if you have one story that's just crap, you can wait for the next one. You don't have to wait for that six story or 13 story arc to finish
In
before
Doctor
it's going to
Who,
be good again.
I think you're absolutely right. I think I prefer it individual stories, but I. As little problem as I had with the last three, the Asylum of the Daleks, I liked it. Is but that's because of my lack of history knowledge, and that's okay. I like the lack of history because it helped me like it more. Dinosaurs on a Spaceship, I absolutely loved.
Oh, it's
A Town
fantastic.
Called Mercy was independent, and I loved it. But this one,
And then they hit this one, yeah.
this one is just a big blob in the road. It's nothing. It's just, and what's amazing is that the ratings on this one are actually higher than something like A Town Called Mercy.
Yeah, I don't get it.
And equal to, the dinosaurs on a spaceship. Now, obviously, the dialects are a little bit different. That one
Well, yeah.
can't
Anytime
even
you have
compare it to
Daleks
that.
on the screen, the ratings go up. So I think we've trashed Power of Three enough. Let's move on to the Angels
Oh,
and
come on. We were on a roll.
Men. Oh, it doesn't
Well, I
stop
have to
there.
say, and before we go on, because this is something that's very rare for me to say, but
Okay.
this is probably the surface level, probably the worst episode of Doctor Who I've watched. I mean, I'm not saying it's just, you know, so yeah. terrible, burn it. I mean, I'd still watch it. I mean, it's still okay. It just, it's the weakest story of Doctor Who that yeah. I've seen. And I don't mean the worst story. I mean the weakest story.
See,
it is truly weak.
This is one that I think had they worked on the script and got the story a little better, they could have expanded this to a two-parter to give it that slow build. And then at the end of that, you find out, oh, it's this invasion. They've taken over. They've done the heart attack on, you know, a third of the population or whatever. And then you have that second part to actually resolve it, and actually have it make sense when they resolve it instead of just.
It could be, but you could also end up with two episodes. Yeah,
could end up with two terrible episodes. But I think, had they had enough time to actually flesh it out and make it a cohesive story, it would have made a really good two-parter, because it is a, when you think about the idea of the actual concept of this invasion plan or whatever it was going to be, collecting the tally or whatever it was, it's actually not a bad idea. You just drop all these seemingly harmless things everywhere, let people get used to them, and then have those study us and exploit our weaknesses. Because humans collect things. That's what we do. Yeah. You know? But
yeah, there was some aspects of it, of the concept of it, that were okay. It's just that the implementation
poorly
was
executed, yeah.
Unfortunately, I don't think it's going to get much better on the next one.
No, I have a lot of bile for the next one here. The Angels Take Manhattan, written by Stephen Moffat and directed by Nick Huron, or I'm not sure how you pronounce his last name. I do apologize. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I have no problem with angels. I have no problem with the concept, but really, the Statue of Liberty, really? No one's watching?
That's
seriously.
That's,
I mean,
literally my first note. The Statue of Liberty, really?
I mean, seriously. I mean, it is hard. It is hard. I you know, I have to admit, and I will admit it right now, way up front. This one, I didn't even go back and rewatch it.
Ah,
because it was.
And you made me watch it again.
I watched The Power of Three because I couldn't remember why I didn't like it. And I forced myself to go all the way through. This one, I didn't watch all the way through because I don't think there is a single freaking angel in this entire thing that follows any of the rules of any of the other angels in any other episode anywhere, even in this own show.
Oh, yeah. I mean, well, the Statue of Liberty is not even made of stone. It's hollow and it's metal.
This thing was just so full of crap that I... I'm glad to see that they put all the crap in all together. Because this is like one of my favorite seasons of Doctor Who, but man, they just stuck it all. And the sad thing is this has one of the highest ratings, and I think it's because it just has the angels in it. People like the angels.
I'm sure it is. And I mean, if we're trying to go with the rules that have been established for the angels in the other stories where they have different rules in every story they're in, isn't there also a rule that says that an image of an angel becomes an angel? That's why there weren't any images in that book about the angels that Amy was looking at.
I think it's even worse than that. We say, let's base this on the rules of the angels and the other episodes that were established. They don't follow their own rules for each of the angels in this episode.
Oh, I know.
From scene to scene.
That's what I'm getting at. You know, how many pictures and postcards and little tiny replicas of the Statue of Liberty are there all over the world?
Oh my God.
If we follow the image of an angel becomes an angel, there's literally billions of tiny Statue of Liberty angels all over this planet.
Well, and not to mention, you know, they make that whole, I don't know, the cathedral or whatever it was, and then keep, like I said, forgive me, because I remembered why I didn't like this one, so I didn't go back and rewatch it. There's probably a lot of it that either I don't remember it because I'm so violently against it, or not so much against it. I mean, you know, you can have a bad episode here and there, but this one is beyond that. This is just lazy, sloppy, bad. It really is, and it's hard. I don't usually say that. I mean, I can say it's sloppy writing from time to time, but this one, they just don't give a shit.
Oh yeah,
they really don't.
I mean, like, okay, here's another good example of what you're talking about there. So, part of the point of the story, or part of the story, was that New York was so full of temporal anomalies because there were so many angels there that the Doctor can't land the TARDIS in New York in, what was it, 1938 or whenever it was. So instead of just landing the TARDIS in New Jersey and taking the train over, they travel
back. Which he normally does anyway.
Yeah. They travel back to ancient China and leave a message on a vase in the hopes that River will notice it in this dude's collection. That seems a tad overcomplicated. I mean, okay, I don't want to have a layover in New Jersey any more than anyone else. But it would be a whole lot easier to just land there and take the train over to New York. I mean, come on. It's insanely complicated for no reason.
Yeah, well, especially considering here in a couple of episodes later, he lands it outside of the bounds and jumps on a motorcycle with his new friend, mm-hmm. and says that he specifically left it outside of the bounds because he doesn't like to bring it into battle.
Yeah.
Hello.
And that brings up my next point in my notes here. So at the time when we saw this episode, we didn't know that Matt Smith's body was the 12th or the 13th incarnation of the Doctor, that was his final body, right? Which we find out later on in the season. He can't regenerate again. So where did he get the regenergy to heal River's wrist when it was broken if he doesn't have any ability to regenerate anymore? Where did he get that from?
Oh.
It didn't even occur to me till I was watching this again, and I'm like, wait a minute, he shouldn't be able to do that anymore, because we find out at the end of the season he can't regenerate, so he shouldn't have that ability.
Didn't have the energy, he can't give it away if he doesn't have it.
Yeah.
Oh. You're right. I didn't even catch that. I caught enough of everything else. And anyone who's listened to it realizes that 99% of the time I'm the one who's saying, oh no, I love every aspect of Doctor Who. But this was not as bad as the previous one, not as bad as the Power of Three. I mean, that one had sloppy writing and just shove it under the rug. This one just had every single thing with angels just, those rules are just kind of, you know,
yeah,
wishy-washy, you know.
Although, as usual, one line did stand out to me in this episode as an excellent line, and it was by Rory, where he says, I always wanted to visit the Statue of Liberty. I guess she got impatient. I love that line. That's like the one redeeming thing in this entire episode is that one line.
That is pretty good. That is pretty good.
But, you know, you've got that shot on the top of the building where Amy and Rory are standing there talking to each other. And they're looking at each other. And the Statue of Liberty weeping angel thing is standing right there at the side of the building. And they stand there and talk for like 2 minutes looking at each other. Is it just letting them have a little alone time before it has a snack? Or why is it standing there letting them talk? Why doesn't it?
Maybe the 16 bazillion people watching the Statue of Liberty were looking in that direction or something.
Nope, I noticed it walking down the street 2 minutes before. So.
Yeah, and that was kind of the problem that I had. And it's like, it goes back to what you said, a picture becomes a thing. So now you kind of think of it. I almost mentioned this earlier and we got sidetracked on the other badness. but here you have a cathedral full of angels.
Hmm.
How many people go and take pictures of this place?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I mean, Statue of Liberty, that's one thing. Okay, great. Let's just say that was some anomaly. But it's a freaking tourist site. I mean, there's got to be bazillions of pictures taken.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the angels were great in the first story that they were in, Blink. They were okay in the next story, but since Flesh and Stone and whatever the other episode was, but They were okay there, but since then they have just gotten worse and worse every time they pull
Well,
them out.
they've done to the Angels what they did to the sonic screwdriver. It's just it's out of control. It just
Yeah.
really is.
Well,
And I don't know if it's just difficult to I can't imagine it being that difficult to say, hey, look, we got to make sure that whatever we do, the Angels don't move if someone's able to see them, and if there's 14 bazillion pictures of them out there, that maybe that would be a bad idea to make them an Angel. And if we're going to put it at a tourist site, I don't know. I just there's so many darn holes in this one and so many stupid things. It just and it's from scene to scene it irritated me. Because
Well,
in one scene they're sitting with their backs to an angel and it's not moving, and the next scene they're staring at it and they blink and it gets 15 feet closer. It's like, really? Which one is it?
and the whole point of this entire episode was to have this heartfelt goodbye to the pawns. And Moffat tries at every turn to have the, to tug at your heartstrings and all that, and it would be successful if the story weren't so terribly, terribly bad.
Yeah.
Because at the end there, when the angel gets Rory in the graveyard, my mind went blank. When the angel gets Rory in the graveyard back once they're in 2012, and then basically Amy sacrifices herself to spend, be able to spend the rest of her life with him. That's nice. That's a good little send off to them. But that's it. It's that one little moment right there at the very end, which still doesn't make any sense because the doctor could still land the TARDIS in New Jersey and take a train over and pick him up. So it's, or they could,
Well, and I don't
fight their
understand
doubts and he
why.
go up there or whatever. It doesn't matter, but.
Well, here's what I don't understand. What did they do that was in this story that was so damned important that they needed to break all these rules? And I mean, do they just not care?
They don't care.
I mean, does. And I don't know if this is, just a Moffat thing, or is this just, they just, he just simply doesn't care.
And when you get there at the very end of the episode, that angel sends both Amy and Rory back to whenever it was, 1935, 38, whatever it was. And then the doctor and River just get in the TARDIS and leave that angel in a cemetery in New York in 2012.
Yeah, hey,
Wait a
that's
minute.
okay. There was a whole bunch of them downtown
But
in the cathedral, so it didn't really matter.
I'm just like, what?
Yeah.
What? Did you not look at your own script? Did you just like wake up from a dream one night, scribble this down on a notepad, and then hand it to people and tell them to start filming? I mean,
Yeah.
what was wrong?
That's exactly what it seems like. It just seems like, okay, here's what we're going to have them do, and I don't care what we have to twist to make it happen. This is what we're going to do. And they're like, but if we do that means we have to do this. Okay, well then that's what we do. Who cares? I mean, it's what it seems like. It really does. That's exactly what it seems like they did.
Yeah.
It's,
I don't
and like you said, I think it was a great send off to them. It was very touching and all that kind of stuff. But I don't see any reason or anything so special that it was necessary to do what they did. I think they could have written. I think they not with any, without too much more effort. They could have made everything that happened happen.
Well, and what gets me is that they've, for some reason, they've decided in the new series of Doctor Who, with pretty much all the companions except for Martha, that something has to happen to make it so that the companion can never see the Doctor again. They have to be trapped in another dimension that he can't get access to, except they bring her back every season. Or, they're stuck in New York where he can never go, except, they could go somewhere else or he could go somewhere else and they could meet up. Or, Donna's memory's wiped and she can never think of the doctor or see him again, or her brain will explode. It's they've got to do something like that with all of the companions, or they can't just have one decide, no, I'm going to leave. I've found something
Yeah.
important that I need to do. Like, that's exactly what Martha did. She's like, no, I have to take care of my family. I have to stay here. And
So
she went on
basically
with
what
her
we're
life. She's
saying,
the only one that's done that.
is that he can take his sonic screwdriver and he can reprogram robots that are here to steal human consciousness, and he can reprogram them with a sonic screwdriver, and he can determine anomalies and fly over to see Claire on a phone that calls him in another dimension, but he can't pick up a freaking phone and call her in New York.
Yeah.
Or call some, or program something else to come visit him somewhere else, or, you know, go to New Jersey and pick up an actual phone and say, hey.
But that's just, I mean, in the classic series, companions would join up with the doctor, they would travel around for a while, and eventually they would either want to go home so they could, you know, have the rest of their lives with their friends and family, or they would decide, hey, I'm going to stay on this planet and help these people out because they really need someone to help them out, and I think this is what I could do with my life. And they basically move on from the doctor. You know, they join up with him, learn a lot of stuff, he makes them into better people, and then they move on with their lives, and they help other people in ways that they can do, and he goes on about his travels and picks up another companion. The new series doesn't seem to want to allow people to do that. There has to be some traumatic separation thing that goes on for a companion to actually leave. Martha is the one exception, and hers is still kind of iffy because there was the whole trauma done to her family by the Master thing, and that's why she stayed behind. But there's no reason why she couldn't travel with him again at some point in the future, whereas with the others, they're saying, no, they're completely off limits, that he can never see them again. I'm just like, no, have a companion just move on. You know, decide this is enough of this. Yeah. I want a normal life, or I want to stay on this planet and help these people out and help them rebuild their civilization. Well,
they almost did it with the Pawns, but then they turned around and came back and got them. And
well, yeah, they
finished it.
The episode right before this one, they decided they were gonna stop traveling with the Doctor and have a normal life. And then Brian's like, "No, you need to travel with him." And then this episode, they get sent back in time. It was very, very... The Power of Three should have been their last story. They should have just decided, no, we're going to have... We like being able to plan our lives out and, you know, be able to schedule going to a friend's wedding or something 4 months in advance and actually be able to do it.
And what you're not saying that you disagree that some of them couldn't end this way. You're just saying you disagree that all of them have to end this way.
Well, yeah, I mean, occasionally you want to have some big traumatic thing happen. Or you know, maybe the companion gets killed. You know, that's been known to happen in the past. It could happen again. Just, you know, it doesn't always have to be this way. They can actually just move on. And it's stupid that it's always like this for some reason.
Yeah. No, it's oh, well.
And I'm sorry, dear listeners, we just happen to have a batch of episodes this time around that I really, really did not care for the most part.
Yeah.
I do like Doctor Who. I really do.
Oh no. Yeah. And you know what? This is probably one of the very few episodes that you'll hear me actually complain about it at all. Cause I usually like most everything they do. And that brings us to,
well, that's
the magic wandman. I mean, snowman.
Yeah. Angels Take Manhattan was the end of season 7B or 7A. So now we're moving on to the Christmas special for 2013, or actually it was 2012's Christmas special, The Snowman, written again by Stephen Moffat and directed by Saul Metstein.
You know, this episode has you know, what I don't even know how to explain it, but it seems to be a trend going on in Doctor Who, is that there's this giant buildup and all this work done to tell this story.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, we call it the magic wand or the pixie dust or whatever you want to call it. And something clicks and then there's just this solution and it's just done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's just over. And
no, I think I think Troy had it right, because they've been doing this for the most part, not always, but for the most part they've done this in the new Doctor Who since it came back, and Russell T. Davis kind of started this, and Troy as far as I know, Troy is the one that termed this phrase, and it's the Tinkerbell moment, where
yeah.
everything is basically written into a corner, and then all of a sudden, one fantastical thing happens that magically solves the whole problem. And Moffat's been better about it than Russell T. Davies was, but this episode is another example of the Tinkerbell moment at the end of it. But before we jump to the end, let's discuss some of the stuff we did and didn't like in the actual episode itself before we get to the horrifically poorly written.
Oh, we're gonna do a did this time?
Do what?
Sorry, sarcasm was bleeding out.
So one of the things I liked about this was that they had Sir Ian McKellen as the voice of the Great Intelligence. Ian McKellen in Doctor Who. Yeah, he was a disembodied voice of a snow globe, but hey. It was Ian McKellen. That's awesome. Okay, so much for the good stuff in the episode.
Oh, I was hoping the moment was going to continue.
Well, no, actually, I like the new intro because they got the Doctor's face back into it, and that's the way it should be.
You know, when the intro is the second item on your on your list of items, this isn't going to be good.
Well, and they had some brilliant casting. Richard E. Grant is a great actor. He plays a great villain. He was woefully underused in this because he just basically stood around with a bad look on his face, like he had really bad gas or something, and occasionally would say something. Woefully underutilized. They should have given him a lot more to do. I think it would have helped this story a lot.
This and you know, and I don't and mind a bit of a I don't mind of a bit of a Tinkerbell moment or a magic smoke or whatever you want to call it moment in a Christmas story. You kind of figure you got to have it a little bit because it is a Christmas story. That's, you know,
I will give the Christmas stories a certain amount of slack because they are a Christmas story and they should be fun Christmassy kind of stories that you watch on Christmas Day, but you know, after Christmas dinner or something like that. But come on, it's Richard E. Grant. Give him something to do. You know, he's a great actor. He's played the Doctor twice. Once for Stephen Moffat in his Children in Need comedy special back in the 90s. He played one of the characters, or he was one of the people the Doctor regenerated into. And then also in the early 2000s, when they were talking about Doctor Who was going to come back as a web animated series, an animated web series, Richard E. Grant was the Ninth Doctor in what was going to be the official continuation of Doctor Who until they found out that, no, actually, we're bringing it back for TV. So, you know, give this man something to do. He's a good actor. And okay, now we come to Strax. I have issues with Strax. He's funny. I find him very humorous. That should not be in Doctor Who. He should be in a spin-off of Doctor Who that's aimed more towards children. He shouldn't be in the main series. I love the bit with the memory worm where he's, you know, under the under the coach, and he's like, oh, I appear to have been run over. But I don't know. I can let it slide so much in a Christmas special, but they keep bringing him back in the regular series.
Yeah, and you know, I don't really remember this episode all that well. And the more you're talking about it, I remember pieces and parts of it. And I remember, you know, it seemed like it was a little bit of forced comedy with him. Mm-hmm. It got relatively good ratings. And if I remember correctly, when we did our initial review, as far as a Christmas episode, I mean, we didn't give it all thumbs down. A rewatchability, it's completely
Yeah, it has terrible rewatchability.
Yeah.
First time through, it's actually fairly enjoyable if you don't mind all the slapstick stuff with Strax in it.
Yes.
Which again, for a Christmas special, I can let a lot of that slide. But in a normal episode of Doctor Who, he should not be in there, and they keep bringing him back. I mean, I usually find one line in an episode that I really enjoy, and it was Strax this time, and he had that one line when the guy comes to visit Madame Vastra, and he Strax is her doorman, and he says, "Do not attempt to escape, or you will be obliterated. May I take your coat?" That's a line you're not going to hear out of anybody else, really. But again, only in a Christmas special or in a spin-off, something like Torchwood or the Sarah Jane Adventures or something like that. I'd be
Yeah.
fine with that. I think they should give Madame Vastra, Jenny, and Strax their own spin-off. And,
Yeah, that would work.
aim it at, tweens and little kids. Strax is perfect for that audience. That's, where he belongs is in something like that, not in my main Doctor Who.
Yeah, it don't fill the Doctor Who full of the, what I call the potty humor, the just silly
Yeah, the silly
slapstick.
slapsticky stuff that just shouldn't be in
Yeah.
there. And then
Yeah.
I did like the scene where the doctor confronts Richard E. Grant's character, Professor Simeon or Mr. Simeon, in his headquarters there. And the doctor's dressed up as Sherlock Holmes, and he's pretending to be Sherlock Holmes and making all these wild assumptions, and they actually play part of the Sherlock theme stinger tune in there from Stephen Moffat's Sherlock series. That was a nice little nod and a nice little touch.
Wow, you remember a lot about this one. I don't
I
remember
made
hardly
notes.
anything.
I had to
I
watch it
didn't.
a second. Actually, this was my third time to watch it. I made notes, so I have to do
I think I missed it. I think I missed it because it was a
it.
Christmas special, so I didn't see it. Again, I intentionally missed the one with the angels, but this one I just.
Well, and then
Although it is.
I have other notes here where Strax is talking about how we should use automated laser monkeys and projectile acid fish. What is that? He does this in like every episode he's in. I recommend we make use of blah 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 blah, and he spits off all this gibberish that makes no sense whatsoever. Projectile acid fish? What is why?
Well, from where he's from, that would be the right weapon to use.
No, it's not. Santarans use Meson lasers.
Yeah, they made him a silly character, and the big thing, yeah, no, this episode was a very Christmassy episode, and it was a lot of it I was able to overlook, but only because a lot of the times you don't rewatch the Christmas episode, it's not something that you.
Yeah, there's a reason for that most of the time.
Yeah,
And these are why.
and this is one of those too that just. You watch it the first time, and then after the ending, you don't want to sit through the whole thing again. There's no payoff. There's nothing.
The other thing that I really enjoyed in this episode, because there are so few, was the new control room. I love the TARDIS
Yes.
control room. I think it looks great. It
Yes. Okay, that I agree with.
looks like something that you could control a time spaceship from. It doesn't look like something you cobbled together from a garage sale and stuff you had, in your tool shed. It looks like something that would actually control a spaceship or a time ship. It looks amazing.
Yeah, no, I agree with that one.
And I like the fact it doesn't have that orange lighting stuff anymore. It's so much soothing, so much more soothing to look at the control room now.
Was that the one that was the winning design that they had the contest for?
I don't think so. No, this was just one that they came up with.
I don't ever remember what happened to that contest they had.
Oh, they had that contest a couple years ago, where they had kids turn in their ideas for TARDIS, and that was the one that was in the Neil Gaiman penned episode, The Doctor's Wife, where they the Doctor and Idris built the TARDIS out of spare parts. And that's where they used the kid's design was for the junkyard TARDIS that they
Oh,
built.
that's right.
And they
Yeah.
actually sold a playset of that. And gave the young girl, I cannot remember her name, they gave her credit on the box as she was the designer of it.
Yeah, I kind of remember. I remember that. I was thinking that it was one of these, but no, it wasn't. Okay, no, but you're right. They did a good job of showing the redesign of that. So how often does that change? Does that change? Does he just redesign it whenever he's in the mood?
Yeah, pretty
And so,
much. That's basically whenever he feels like it.
and I guess considering when this one started, if I remember correctly, this is the one where he was kind of pouting and crying in his milk and or crying in his beer, I guess, and this and could be the right
Yeah.
wording. But and the snowmen are the bad guys, and then he comes and Claire comes and points it out, and he didn't want to do anything about it. He just wants to continue pouting, and then she finally kind of pushes him, and he realizes, oh, wait a minute, this is somebody I need to pay attention to, kind of. Is
Yeah.
that right? Is that the right story? Okay.
Yeah. Now, I did like also they did a couple callbacks to the Patrick Troughton Great Intelligence episodes, which is where that villain was originally created, was back with Patrick Troughton. They had an episode called The Abominable Snowmen, and this was the Snowmen, so that was a nod there to that title.
Not snow ninjas,
Yeah,
not to be
not
confused with snow
sninjas,
ninjas.
yeah. But they had nods back to that. They had nods to the Web of Fear, which was the second episode or story with Patrick Troughton and the Great Intelligence in the London Underground, because the 11th Doctor in this talks to the when he's talking to the Great Intelligence, he talks to it about how important the London Underground is, and he gives it a map of the London Underground from the 60s, which is when the Great Intelligence invades the London Underground, is in the 1960s. So this is kind of a prequel to that episode. So he's getting all that's all set up in this. I kind of like that effect of the timey-wimey here actually works for me. I enjoyed that. But it was very, very minimal use of the Great Intelligence here as well. A villain like that should be a bigger threat than it was here in this episode.
Yeah, they seem to sometimes it's amazing how they seem to take something that's very significant or should be very significant in the thing and underuse it, and then things that should only be part of the story, not the story, they magnify them and make it the whole thing.
Yeah. And then, of course, sad feelings at the end is what defeats the Great Intelligence. Because everybody's
Yeah.
sad because Clara has died. Come on, really? The Doctor is supposed to figure out a solution and implement it. He's supposed to solve the problem or stop the bad guy in some way, shape, or form using reason, intelligence, and possibly some technology. It shouldn't be because everybody felt bad.
Yeah, I mean, well, and come on, this is another one of those things where, okay,
There's our
everybody felt
finger.
bad. Really? The whole world, everyone, just boop, okay,
No,
oh,
just that handful of people. That's enough.
yeah, and that's enough. You know, the fact that he was, in disarray before he got, the Christmas spirit, and this, I don't know. That I just saw this as another one of those very weak endings that just annoyed the crap out of me, because it's like there's all this build up and then it just.
And I had another one here that I did not notice this the first two times around when I watched this story. But I think it's because I watched all of them in quick succession this time around. I did a binge watch to get through them all. At the end there, Clara tells the doctor the famous line, "Run, you clever boy, and remember." And the doctor remembers her saying that
Yep.
from the Asylum and the Daleks. I went back and I watched the last part of Asylum of the Daleks yet again, because it didn't feel right when I saw this. She says that after he leaves in Asylum of the Daleks. So unless she's like transmitting it over the PA system or something, he never heard her say it the first time.
Yeah, she kind of mumbled it to herself. I thought so too. She kind of like looked at herself after they had been cut off, and he's running back to the ship to get out of there,
and
she goes running.
And she kind of says it off to the side to herself, and I'm just like, Mr. Moffat, you should check on these things since you wrote them both.
Maybe she was transmitting.
That's my only assumption at this point, but I'm not willing to give him that.
I don't think I would either.
I shouldn't have to make those assumptions. So,
no, you're right.
Again,
but you know, the sad part is that, and I don't know if it's because he picks the storylines that have, you know, but a lot of the ratings of the ones he do are very high.
Oh, it's because everybody thinks he's a great writer. He's not.
And it just, I'm amazed at how lazy some of it is. I mean, he's got some good ideas, but he needs someone to come behind him and tighten them up.
Well, and again, I'll say this again. When he was writing one or two episodes a year, when Russell T. Davies was running the show, Stephen Moffat's episodes were the best episodes. And his first season, when he took over, that was a good, solid season as far as I'm concerned. I really enjoyed the whole thing. I think he's basically, and we've talked about this before, the last couple seasons, he keeps reusing the same ideas that he used in those episodes back that he wrote for Russell T. Davies and for his first season. He just keeps reusing the same ideas again and redressing them in a different setting. But it's the same exact ideas. And I think he's out of ideas.
It could be.
And he's that, and maybe he's getting pulled in too many directions by also doing Sherlock. But, you know, I think he should step back and run, maybe, you know, have him step back and run the show and let more writers come in and write, you know, their own episodes instead of having him write half the season. Because the last 2 years, his episodes have all been the ones I've hated. The ones written by other people are usually better episodes. Which is a shame, because the next one is written by Stephen Moffat. Okay. Are we ready to move on to the next one?
Yeah, we're ready.
Okay, so the first real part of Series 7B, The Bells of St. John, written by Stephen Moffat and directed by Colm McCarthy. Okay. So what'd you think of this one?
You know, I hate to continue this trend, but
I want to keep going till I find one I like.
I
want to end on an up note.
I have a serious problem with almost every aspect of the technology involved in this one, of the way things are done in this one, let's start off by saying, okay, in two episodes prior to this, when we were butchering him for, you know, not landing in another city and driving in, this one, what does he do?
Yeah.
He lands on the other side of town because he doesn't want to, you know, take the, and not because he doesn't want to get noticed, not because of this, not because of that. Exactly the reason that he couldn't go to New York. Wow. Because he doesn't want the TARDIS involved in war.
Well, yeah,
because
he doesn't.
It's too powerful.
Doesn't
want it falling into bad hands, and he says it exactly those words.
I'm okay with that logic there. The TARDIS is too dangerous for someone else to get their hands on it. I'm fine with that. That makes sense.
I don't have a problem with that. I have a problem with the fact that it conflicts with everything
past. Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, true. If I can't just land right next to you, I'm not going to bother. Yeah.
Yeah. And then, you know, some pieces of the technology here are just kill me. I mean,
I was wondering if you were going to bring up the way the Wi-Fi works. Cause yeah, it's
yeah. So
us both coming from a technical background, watching this episode is painful.
It was extremely painful. I mean, and here we have it again. So all these people's consciences are downloaded and all these people's bodies are laying there dead of a conscience, and you know, hey, let's just snap our fingers and fix it.
You're jumping to the end again, Matt.
No, I'm not. This is at the very beginning. The first thing that happens, he takes his magic wand and he points it at a robot that's downloading a human, the human conscience, and he reverses the process and puts it back into her. Okay, so problem solved. Episode ends. The end. I'm just amazed if it goes on like that, and then. You know, it goes. It gets even worse. It gets even worse from there. I mean, it just. And it's just, the funny part is that sometimes if you watch these episodes and you watch them the first time and you see them on TV and stuff, they're okay.
That's when you when you go back and watch them a second time and you actually look at it and you're like, ooh.
Yeah, it's not like going back and watching dinosaurs and spaceships and you laugh and you think, you look at his face and see that boy wonder look in his face of, oh, man, check this out. There's dinosaurs in a spaceship, that kind of stuff. Or, you know, even the Dalek scene, you know, the very first one there, the Asylum of Daleks. I mean, at least there was. It's the rewatchability. If you didn't enjoy it, at least the pieces that you did enjoy are still there the second time through. This one, as with the previous couple, the same problem. And I mean, I had just watched this one before we started recording, and I'm just sitting there shaking my head, going, I can't believe some of the crap that they tried to pull over our eyes on this.
Yeah, now. This one, I will admit, I like it better than the last few that we've talked about. There were some nice things in it that I liked. They had the book that the kids were reading at the beginning of it, Summer Falls by Amelia Williams, which is Amy Pond. She became a writer. She was, you know, her name was Amelia Pond, and she's married to Roy Williams, so she is Amelia Williams. I liked that. That was a nice little nod. I do wonder who the woman in the shop that gave Clara the doctor's phone number is. Who had his phone number to give to her? I want to know this. That's not a number everybody knows.
that was one of those unexplained things that you thought they were going to resolve later, where she was going to run into somebody or... he was going to, you know, something would be mentioned but nothing. You heard nothing about it, nowhere, anywhere whatsoever. One of the most intriguing aspects of the beginning of this story. And they leave it blank.
Yeah. And then, okay. So remember the bit with the plane? They're going to crash the plane on the doctor and Clara to get rid of him.
Yep.
Seems a little bit overkill, but okay. It makes a statement. Yeah. you know, he lands the TARDIS on the plane, which I've only been on a few airplanes in my life, airliners, but none of them have been tall enough to hold the TARDIS standing upright. Because that thing's like
in the aisle.
Yeah, that thing's like 9 feet tall. I almost hit, I'm only 6'1", and I almost hit my head in an airplane.
yeah.
But beyond that, I'll let that slide because it's TV. But with all that on the airplane, with them flailing all over the place and it diving and climbing and all that stuff, Clara doesn't spill a drop of her coffee out of her coffee mug.
That went through my mind, too. As a matter of fact, when she got back to the TARDIS to figure out what was going on, she finished it, exactly. Took the last swallow.
Exactly.
I'm like, that was kind of a cool idea for them to carry the cup through. But if she had gone to take a drink and looked at it like, why is it empty? That would have been enough to make you think, okay, that's cool.
But see, that was one of the things that I like about Doctor Who and that I did enjoy in this episode was, you know, the planes flying at him, it's going to crash and wipe out, you know, the doctor, Clara, that house and probably several houses around it. So instead of doing what in most TV shows or movies, the main characters would just run out of the way of the plane and it would crash and kill all those people. The doctor hops in his TARDIS, lands on the plane lands the TARDIS on the plane and then saves the plane.
Now,
other shows
do
can you do that on?
And very few, considering that when this show was written, that the door was locked and he couldn't have gotten in.
Oh, that's what the sonic screwdriver's for.
That's true.
Undoes
Well, it's
locks. That's what it actually is for. It will undo locks.
The next question, yeah, and so, okay, I'll let that go. I mean, they didn't show it, and I mean, he ran up there, and yeah. The plane was headed towards the ground, and you know, just kind of walked right in on him, and no big deal. But we'll just assume he used the sonic screwdriver to unlock the door after parking his 8 foot tall call box in a 4 foot corridor.
Yeah.
Barely has enough room for my luggage to fit down, but yet this
it's TV.
Now, I did like, I have to say, you know, you're right, I like the idea that the book had, you know, kind of had her name on it and that kind of stuff. Okay, that's really cool. I did like the way the doctor took the bite out of the cookie, fed her bed, he put the things in there, and he went down and sat by the call box, and he just waited for her, and she's like, are you here guarding me? And he's like, yep.
Yeah. I assembled the quadricycle you had in the garage. The what? I've invented the quadricycle.
Yeah. That section of this episode was Doctor Who. That's you know, that was entertaining. It was light. It was funny. It wasn't corny. There wasn't any broken pieces. There was, you know, it was very, I thought that part of it was very entertaining and very good.
Well, and
up to the point they landed it onto the airplane.
And actually at the end of this, he doesn't use the sonic screwdriver to solve the problem. He actually uses the technology that they were using to pull these people's minds out of their bodies and reverses the process with the technology that was already there. I mean, yeah, he does it really super quick and all, but that's because he's the doctor. But at least we know the technology had the ability to pull it out, so it could be said that inversely you could put it back using the same equipment.
Well, the only problem I had with the pulling it out and then putting it back was the fact that he pointed a sonic screwdriver at it, and voila, the receptor of data becomes the sender of data.
Well, that was just with Clara at the beginning, though. At the end, though, he actually uses their computer systems to do it.
Yes. Well, yeah, no, and that's fine.
And I'll buy that with Clara at the beginning simply because that's how he used to solve a lot of problems, was by reversing the polarity of the neutron flow. So he basically just reverses it.
I just wish they would stop pointing the sonic screwdriver solving problems like that, because what it basically makes you wonder is, when he doesn't point the sonic screwdriver, like, why don't he just point it at it and fix it?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, if it's that easy to hack the device to get it to do that, I mean, had he jumped up on it and knocked it down and climbed on the back of its head and used a sonic screwdriver to shut it down and pulled a couple wires out, plugged a few things in and, you know, twisted it this way, twisted it that way, turned it on and it put her back, I'd have been cool with it.
Yeah. No, I think that would have made a better story. Yeah.
Yeah. But this fact that he just, you know, oh no, you're not going to do that here. And she goes back to 0% transmitted, you know, what? That's craziness.
Yeah.
And the Wi-Fi piece, we won't even go into that. That just...
I love how when it's controlling people, like in that cafe, for some reason they have these matrixy character sequences scrolling all over their faces and stuff from an invisible projector out of nowhere.
But, yeah, that was...
And then at the end, we find out that it's the Great Intelligence again. Which, again... I like the Great Intelligence. He's a great concept for a villain. He's a very powerful villain. Why are we underutilizing him so many times in a row here?
Now, he just the shows one up thing I have
like,
to
oh,
say...
beat me, I'm gone now, you know?
Yeah. But I have to say, the one thing that I really thought was very creative was, and it was done vaguely enough to where you had to be paying attention. Mm-hmm. But when she said... you've been with me so long, I'm not sure I know what to do, or I'm not sure I know how to do it. And he left, and she reverted back to a child.
Yeah, which was when he had taken her over.
That was kind of cool.
That was good, and I do not know the actress's name, but she did an excellent job in this episode, all the way through it. But there at the end, particularly when she reverts to childhood, she did an
amazing job. Yeah, because you think that she's just going to go back to being, you know, a person or something like that, or take something with her. But I mean, when she reverts back to a kid, you think, wow, that's pretty cool. That means that, you know, he took her for all these years and then didn't deposit any knowledge the entire time.
Yeah, no, he just
used her.
Yeah, exactly.
Which does bring up the question of how is she aware of the fact that he was leaving and blah, 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 if she didn't learn anything over those years. But still, that's overlookable because it was a cool concept. But no, that part of it I thought was really cool. I think the solution was a really cool idea too, where he hacked the, you know, it took Claire, and it irritated him, so he hacked the bot and sent the bot over to take her out. Now that was cool, but I didn't like the magic wand solution again. Mm-hmm. Which is just, it's like you've got all the elements for a great, I don't want to call it a fight scene, but you know what I mean. A great ending, a good battle, battle's really not the right word. Neither is fight, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, a good showdown.
And it's head turns around and sucks her out and boop, we're done. Congratulations. Yep. You win. Really? We just took this whole building down, all the bad guys, everything, mm-hmm. all of it, everything's gone because you waved your magic wand at yourself and it drove over there and took them all out.
Yeah. But again, you know, he, once he took it over, he used it to basically force them to put everything back, which is typical Doctor style, is making someone else or the bad guy themselves defeat themselves at the end.
Yeah, but I think it could have been
it could have been done better. Yeah,
it could have been a little bit more of a dramatic, you know. As the problem is that the buildup is never as good as the ending with these things. They do all this great job of telling the, you know, in this one, and I don't want to say a great job, but they did a decent job of telling you what was going on. And then at the end, it just kind of, boop, okay, we're done. And it's kind of like, and I've gotten even where you notice it. It's like, okay, there's only 5 minutes left. They're going to come up with a, you know, there's going to be three more minutes of show, and then there's going to be a solution.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, it's not like watching, you know, any other show where, you know, there's these multiple climaxes and sometimes there's false security and da da da. This one, it's like, you know, it's going to happen in the last 2 or 3 minutes. That's it.
Yeah.
There's going to be one solution. It's going to be very simple. He's going to, you know, hit him with a stick. He's going to wave his sonic screwdriver. He's going to land on him with a call box. It's going to be something like that. And poof, it's going to be all done. Well, everybody's sad. Oh, they all melt.
Yeah.
You know, it just... I don't know. I'm not real impressed with it. And again, it got decent ratings. I just think they have so much other potential with some of these stories. I mean, some of these concepts are really good too. I mean, this was a good concept. It was a good idea. Yeah. Power of Three was a good concept. Angels in Manhattan was a good set. The Snowmen was a decent concept. I wouldn't say that one was a good concept. But it was a decent concept. But the storytelling in all four cases was just... Were they all Moffat? No, the first
one. No, not all of them. Most of them.
Three of the four.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, I have to say, yeah, and the good news is I think that does put an end to most of the bad ones for me.
Well, that's good.
Uh-oh.
So, are we ready for the next one?
Are we going to do another one? All right.
Yeah, let's do another one, because then when we start the next one, they'll, like, be good ones.
Yes.
I can do good ones next time.
You're absolutely right, because Cold War really starts a cool group of them. Okay. So, Let's do Rings of
The Rings of Akatan.
Akatan. Now,
written by Neil Cross and directed by Farron Blackburn.
Okay. Now let me start by saying the visuals on this one are just fantastic. Don't care about the storyline, but all the storyline aside, you have to admit some of the visuals and some of the concepts of the visuals behind this one are just awesome.
Oh, no, I completely agree. This episode looks fantastic.
Okay, let's end it there. Ian, thanks. See you next time.
This episode is looks really well done. I cannot fault the director. Unfortunately, that means it goes to the writer. Yeah, I kind of liked the bit at the beginning with Clara's parents and the whole little backstory on her. I kind of have to wonder why the leaf in this is completely different kind of leaf from a different kind of tree than the one we saw in the previous episode, which is supposed to be the same leaf.
Yeah.
Well, one episode ago,
to get those trees in the right spot, you know.
One episode ago, they show us the leaf, and then in the very opening sequence of this episode, it's a completely different leaf. You'd think they'd have
time changed them.
You'd think they'd have, you know, like someone in charge of, I don't know, continuity or something.
Somebody to catch it, yeah. Yeah,
especially since it plays such a pivotal part in this episode.
This one, I'm not gonna talk about anything but the visuals on this one. This one looked really good.
The marketplace, the Akatan marketplace with all the aliens and all, looked amazing. They spent a fortune on those costumes because those were all brand new aliens.
That was just awesome. The whole scene with her walking down the thing, and I loved it when she turned around and he's gone.
Yeah,
that was just. Her, she's a wonderful actor on top of it, so that just made it just all the better. I just, that part of it was really, I'm not going to say anything bad about this one. I'm leaving all the bad to you.
What I enjoyed about this was, like I said, all the aliens were new. They didn't just recycle costumes that they had had in previous episodes. They went and designed entirely new alien races and filled this marketplace with them. And like I said, the direction was good. The lighting was excellent. Everything was lit properly in scenes where it was supposed to be dark and dim. It looked dark and dim, and spots where it was supposed to be vibrant and bright and had all these colors, it looked great. The vigil, the bad guys with the vent mask things on their heads, they looked awesome. They looked like some really good bad guys. Unfortunately, they didn't actually do anything other than whisper ominously and stick their hands out and shoot force wavy things that didn't do anything. But they looked awesome. They should have been such a cool villain, and they weren't. I also want to know, when they're like singing the songs and everything, how does sound travel between those planetoids in the vacuum of space? How does how does grandfather, or whatever they called the thing on the little pyramid thing out there, how does it hear her singing? They didn't explain
that.
Don't
get technical. Just consider it as Wi-Fi and just click on it. And
The two choristers in the episode, the little girl and then the guy that was in the pyramid singing, they're actually professional opera singers, both of them.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they went out and got professional singers, which is why they sounded so good. I like that. They went to the level of effort to get people that could actually sing these things and make them sound beautiful.
Well, and that's got to be all based on the director, because like you said, it looks fabulous. The casting is fabulous. All the different aliens was just really cool. The visual effects was cool. The concept was cool. It's just some of the technical behind the scenes pieces don't make sense if you realize that sound don't travel through space.
Oh yeah. Well, like, what'd you think of the space jet ski?
Yeah.
Shouldn't they have needed some sort of, I don't know, spacesuit or air tank or something to get from one planetoid to the other? And why was their hair blowing in the wind? So see, my best assumption, and again, I'm
just telling you, you just got all these bad things to say about this episode. Didn't it look great?
Oh, it looked awesome. But again, I'm having to make a wild assumption here that could have been fixed with one single line of dialogue, or two lines of dialogue, actually. Clara could have said, how can he hear them? Or how can we breathe in space on this thing? And all that would have required would have been the doctor saying, oh, they've created a air shield around this entire area so that they can travel back and forth between the planetoids without having to wear spacesuits. That would have solved all the technical problems I had. Well, most of the technical problems I had with this episode right there. That would have explained both of the singing through space and the space jet ski with no space helmets.
There had to have been something there, because I mean, if you look at the space jet ski, what was it called in Star Wars? The pod racer.
Yeah.
No, not the pod racer.
Hover bike or a speeder bike or whatever it was. Yeah.
Yeah, the speeder bikes that they used in the forest.
Mm-hmm.
if you look at it, I mean, there's just no question that they were just flying through open space with it. So. Yeah, that's pretty weak. It was pretty much left out.
Then you get to the pyramid.
Well, and we're not talking about the bad stuff, because there was a lot of bad things that happened at the pyramid that we're just leaving out of this episode. So we're going to end on a good note, regardless if you want to or not.
If the doctor is using the sonic screwdriver to open the door, right?
Uh-huh.
Why does it matter how heavy the door is? Because he's talking about how heavy it is and he can barely hold this. And no, that's not how that works.
Yeah, that was one of the issues that I had with it. I was like, I don't understand why any of this matters if you're just waving that little magic wand at him.
Yeah. Well, and again, we had the alarm clock vampire alien dude thing in the glass box. Looked awesome. His costume was great. He looked like he'd be a really good bad guy that could do some damage.
I remember when I was watching this, I remember going back and going through it several different times and watching of the costumes.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the costumes on some of this is just, the thought that had to have gone into them.
Oh yeah,
is just amazing, because we're not talking about just clothing. I mean, they had makeup, they had hair, they had
masks,
appendages and masks and add-ons.
Some of them had breathing apparatus and stuff. Yeah, they spent a lot of time and money on it.
And some of them's heads were just way different. And I mean, it was just amazing how much effort and time went into that.
Yeah, and I mean, the alarm clock vampire dude looked awesome. Unfortunately, all he does is stand in a glass box and bang his fists and roar. That's all he does. He doesn't do anything else in this episode. Like the Vigil, they don't do anything. And then, of course, we have the doctor speechifying to the Great Pumpkin, which is the big bad guy in the episode, the Great Pumpkin in space.
Yeah, the big planetoid pumpkin face.
Apparently they spent all the money on the other alien costumes that were just primarily background dressing.
Which is amazing, because if you look through... didn't have
anything left for the main guy.
Yeah, I mean, there are so many awesome costumes. I mean, even if you go through some of the scenes where they're sitting in the crowd and you just look around them, it's not even like they were repeating the costumes in the crowd around them. There weren't couples of people. Every single one of them was different.
Mm-hmm. Now, I did like when he was speechifying to the Great Pumpkin, where the doctor says, I've walked in universes where the laws of physics were devised by the mind of a madman. That's actually a bit of a callback to several classic Doctor Who episodes. The Celestial Toymaker, The Mind Robber, and The Three Doctors are all stories in which the Doctor is actually in parallel or alternate universes that are controlled simply by the will of these beings. And the Three Doctors, it's by Omega, and the Mind Robber, it's by the creator, or the writer, whatever they called him. And in the Celestial Toymaker, it's the actual Celestial Toymaker that's controlling everything, but they literally have total control over everything in the universe. Whatever they will is what happens. So I thought that was a nice little reference back to those.
Well, this one, like you said, and I think I would agree with you, of the previous ones mentioned, this one's by far the best of the four, by a long shot.
You know, that's unfortunate to say, but I think you might be right.
I mean, at least this one has one aspect where if we just didn't talk about the holes in the technology, which seems to be a running problem lately.
Yeah, but just looking pretty isn't enough for a Doctor Who episode.
No, it's not. But it is an aspect of it. It is a part of it. It is one piece of it. And at least this one had that.
See, I don't know. I almost have to give it to the Bells of St. John. I would almost have to say that was my favorite out of this last batch that we've talked about. Simply because of the way this one ends. Wherein, you know, the leaf of infinite impossibilities destroys the big bad guy. And they leave.
Yeah, the magic wand again.
Well, and even beyond that, if I can get past the fact that this leaf somehow gorges this thing so much that it dies, even if I can buy that aspect of it, then the Doctor and Clara just leave the seven planets of Akatan with no sun. So they don't have any source of light, heat, or gravity anymore. What happens to these seven planets that are all inhabited when their sun's gone?
Yeah.
You know, that's a big, giant, gaping thing that needs to be addressed. At the end
well,
of
but
the
you
story.
Know, it's the same. But it's a running problem with these last few episodes. I mean, they did the same thing with the angels leaving them in the thing. They did in the park.
Mm-hmm.
They, you know.
Well, yeah, but that's one angel. That's going to take a little while. This is a whole star that doesn't exist anymore. There's several planets orbiting it.
Yeah.
That are reliant on it for everything, basically. Now it's all gone. They're just going to fling off into space and die. I mean,
yeah.
Did he jury-rig some sort of fake fusion sun that, you know, he spit out of
no,
the TARDIS to keep everything in place, you know?
And the sad part is we're not talking about just, you know, a planet that says, I mean, we're talking about the rings that were living because of the gravity of the sun.
Yeah.
You know,
well, they
but then again, they had the imaginary air. So maybe they have the imaginary, you know, the light and imaginary gravity to go with it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they mentioned at the beginning of it that it's seven inhabited planets in the system here and that they all, you know, trade together and everything and all practice basically the same religion and all. And he's basically just destroyed that whole thing now. Or Clara has destroyed that whole thing now because they don't have a son anymore. I'm sorry, that's a big thing for me.
Yeah.
But it looked fantastic.
It did look fantastic. It just looked. There's some of them that, you know, and there's some of them that you can just turn down and you just watch the special effects and you watch all the characters. This is one of those where, like I said, I mean, I did really literally go back and just pay attention to all the side candy, all the different aliens and stuff. It's like watching, you know, the cantina in Star Wars, you know, all the different aliens that are in there. It's the same thing here. It's amazing how many they were able to pack in there and how much money had to have been spent on it in this particular episode. Cause it's like you said, it wasn't even like they were just a bunch of rehash.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'm guessing they spent all the money on the costumes and didn't have anything else for anything else.
Yeah, and even some of the CGI views from space showing, the pyramids and the rocks and the planets and all that kind of stuff, those were even visually
Oh yeah,
beautiful.
no, like I said, the episode looked fantastic. I mean, I will not fault the visual appearance of this story in any way, shape, or form, other than the fact that the big bad at the end was just a big orangey red ball of stuff. But I guess that
And
was dependent
the
on the
guy in the
story
box
itself.
was just a guy in a box that didn't do anything,
Yeah,
you
but
know.
he looked great not doing anything. But
Reminds me of something. What was it? What is it that he reminds me of? He reminds me of some character. Wasn't the guy who read that led in Babylon 5, the guy who led wow, what was the name of that dude? The guy who led him to crash on the planet, the first. What was it, the first one or something like that?
Yeah.
He looks a lot like him. Matter of fact, I'm going to bring up a picture of him side by side. I bet it is. I bet it does look like him. It's like twice in this week I found characters that look like people from Babylon 5. Let's see. I don't remember his name. Was it the one?
I don't remember. It's been so long since I should watch Babylon 5 again. It's been a while.
Well, he's close. Well, actually, he's really close. Wow. I mean, the head's a little different,
Yeah.
but the top of the head's a little different. But the rest of it, I mean, he has hair and stuff like that. They're just some resemblances, not as much as I thought. No, all the creatures was cool and everything. We'll end it on a great note. I'm not going to say anything more bad about it.
Yeah.
It was an okay, like I said, it was an okay. I mean, it was, if you're talking about the previous four, it I think was probably with its visual thing, the stories were not any stronger and the technical aspects weren't any stronger than the previous episode. But the visual throws this one, I would say, over the edge as being of the four the best, which isn't saying much because
No, yeah, I don't know. It's a tough call for me between this and the Bells of St. John. I'm not particularly fond of any of the four that we or the five that we talked about today.
no, me neither. But on a bright note, our next podcast
Yes.
is going to be full of goodness.
Well.
Well, it's going to have some goodness,
It's
let's
going to
say that.
start with some really good stuff.
Yeah. And that's going to be, some of these episodes coming up are just, especially the next one. I love the
Oh,
next episode.
yeah.
Yes.
I love the next one, too. It's probably, other than the actual anniversary special, this is my favorite one out of the season.
I don't know. Dinosaurs has got me. So,
That is a pretty good one, but I like this
this
one
one
a lot.
is, yeah, this one is just really cool, though. I mean, this is just a really, really cool episode. So that will be good. And I have to go back and rewatch them all again so that we can do it again. All right, then.
right, yep.
On a good note, this was an absolutely fabulous looking episode.
Looked great. Good work, Farron Blackburn.
Yeah.
All right, well, so until next time, we will talk to y'all later.
All right. Oh, wait. And before we go, for those of you who are familiar with Big Dog's little pet project on what was his name? Gosh, you're gonna leave me blank here.
Mark Largent?
Yes. His episode is out. The
Ah, yes,
Walking Dead
the
episode.
Wobbling
What's
Dead, yes.
the Wobbling Dead episode is out. And I just wanted to give a shout out to him and thank him for including our very own previous Big Dog in it.
Yes, as a
And
felt zombie.
as his gets his head lobbed off too, that was quite
Yeah.
entertaining. I thought he was going to live there for a little while, and then goodbye. So I'm not sure of what is his website? Do we know? Yeah, see, this is what happens when I throw things in like this. That's okay. Mark, the wobbling. There we go, wobbling dead. I didn't find it. Crap.
No, I found his Kickstarter page.
Well, we will have to look it up and put it in the show notes for you then.
Yep, we will have it in the show notes. And we will talk to y'all next time then.
It's definitely worth the actual, you know, I think it's like $5 to download and watch.
Oh, yeah. It's
a great recap of season one of The Walking Dead.
in felt form.
Yeah, and just make a kind of comedyizes all the major parts of it and kind of points out how silly some of them were. So, but it was actually really good. So hats off to him. I haven't been able to get a hold of him, but hopefully one of these days we'll get a hold of each other and maybe we can get him on the show to talk about it and tell us what's up on his future projects. So just wanted to mention that and make sure that we didn't let that go another episode without mentioning him.
Yep. Right. I watched it too. It was quite humorous.
Yeah. Yep. All right. Then that's it.
All right. Y'all have a good one.
See you next time.
All right. Bye.